Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast of Hemingway Brain Eacs. We are talking about chapter 7, and then we'll be reading chapter 8 of book 2 of The Red and the Black. Doop-a-doop. Mover and shaker, this kid. Why does he hate London so much? Laura Weistich said, I liked the end of this chapter. Julian is growing in society, gaining advantages when he finally uses his influence by nominating Cholin for a position as a joke. It backfires. I think this sentence, it will be necessary to commit several other injustices if I mean to get on, and also to conceal them beneath pretty sentimental speeches, has some internal conflict. I'm interested to see where Julian goes from here. Excuse me. Non-creative handles. Why is it that I spend a whole day just normal, and then as soon as I press record every bloody time, something has to be annoying? Frog in the throat. Hiccups. You name it. Things in my brain. Slash. Neck. Neck-based problems is what I have every single night. Anyway. Non-creative handle said, the harsh reality of wielding your power. It's not the same, but I remember when my husband and I were planning our wedding, I felt horrible for picking one photographer over the other. My husband had to tell me that not everyone wins and you can't always be nice. That thought Julian had at the end about you gotta be ruthless to make it reminded me of that conversation between us, because life can be like that. You make a choice and someone wins and someone doesn't. Julian made a more significant choice than I did, but the guilt was all too relatable. You know what? I think I need to schmoop up this chapter because I don't know what you guys are talking about. I need to do some vocal warm-ups maybe next time. La 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 la. Chapter, what are we talking about? Seven. Yeah. Chapter 7. Let me just do a quick recap. Oh my god, there's a lot of dot points in chapter 7. Gout. I'm just going to go to the last couple. Monsieur Valenod from Verrieres visits Philomel House as the newly elected mayor of his town. It looks like he beat out Monsieur de Renal for the job. As a joke, Julian recommends a local imbecile for a posting in Verrieres. The Marquis agrees that it would be a good joke and gives the man the position. Only later does Julian realize that he has kept a good, honorable man from getting the position. Feels guilty for toying with people's futures. Okay. All right. Come on, voice. Just be my voice. That's all you need to do. Swim said the Mama Fishy said the philosopher Philip Vane was an invention of Stendhal's. Non-creative handle said the line where Julian is told, I'm not actually raising your status, we're just pretending, hurt a little bit. Julian and I, for that matter, gets caught in the experience and forgets where he really sits. This was the slap in the face that he's still there on invitation only. Makes me wonder if the dating a rich woman thing would have been the more painless option. Speaking of the Renals, the mayor was beaten out. I hope we get more of that story. Yeah, I'm quite certain that we will get more of that story, because that's quite significant, isn't it? That the Renals are no longer the mayor, in the mayorship of that town. Just logging into my account here so I can continue the podcast. Okay, there we go. Let's read chapter 8. Chapter 8 goes like this. What decoration confers distinction is the name of the chapter. Your water does not refresh me, said the thirsty genie, yet it's the coolest well in all Diyarbakir from Pellico. One day Julian got back from Villiquia, a charming estate on the banks of the Seine, which was the especial interest of Monsieur de la Mole because it was the only one of all his estates that had been held by the celebrated Boniface de la Mole. Boniface. At the hotel, I'm sure I'm not saying that right. It's probably got some French pronunciation, but it's just bony face. Bony-faced de la Mole. At the hotel, he found the Marquise and her daughter, just returned from here he is. Julien was a dandy by now and understood the fine points of Parisian life. He displayed a perfect coldness towards Mademoiselle de la Mole. He seemed to have no recollection whatsoever of the occasion on which he had so gaily interrogated him about the details of his way of tumbling off a horse. Mademoiselle de la Mole found him taller and paler. There was no trace of the provincial left in his bearing or his turnout, but this was not so with his conversation. In that one still noticed something too earnest, too positive, yet in spite of this thoughtful element in his speech, was, thanks to his pride, in no way that of an inferior. One simply felt that he still considered too much to be of importance, but one saw that he was a man who would uphold what he said. "He lacks lightness of touch, but not intelligence," remarked Mademoiselle de la Mole, while teasing her father about the cross he had given Julien. "My brother has been asking for one for 18 months. He is a de la Mole." "Yes, but Julien is capable of the unexpected, which is never the case with the de la Mole you mention." Monsieur le Duc de Retz was announced. Matilda found herself seized by a yawning she could not control. She became conscious yet again of the antique gildings in her father's salon and of its ancient inhabitants. She conjured up a completely tedious image of life she was about to resume in Paris, even though at Hiriers she had pined for the city. "And yet I am 19, thought she. "According to all these boobies with gilded edges, it is the age to be happy." She was glancing at 9 or 10 volumes of new verse that had piled up on a side table during their absence in Provence. She was unfortunate enough to be cleverer than Monsieur de Croisenoli, de Caylus, de Lutz, and her other friends. She could predict everything they were going to say to her about the fine sky of Provence, poetry, the south, etc., etc. Those lovely eyes in which breathed the deepest ennui, and still worse, a despair of ever finding pleasure, paused on Julien. "At least, he is not precisely the same as everyone else." "Monsieur Sorel," said she, in the lively, clipped and completely non-feminine voice used by young women of the upper class, "Monsieur Sorel, are you going to be at Monsieur de Retz's ball tonight?" "Mademoiselle, I haven't had the honour of being introduced to Monsieur le Duc." It was as if these words were, and that title scorched the lips of the haughty provincial. "He has charged my brother with bringing you along, and if you were to come, you could tell me some little things about the estate of Villequier. There is some question of us going there in the spring, and I'd like to know if the chateau is inhabitable, and if it is as pretty round there as it is said to be. So many reputations are fraudulent." Julien did not reply. "Come to the ball with my brother," she added in a driest tone. Julien gave a respectful bow. "So, even at a ball, I must be accountable to all members of the family. Aren't I paid to be a manager of business affairs?" In his ill temper, he added, "God knows if what I say to the daughter won't contradict the plans of the father, the brother, and the mother. It is really like the court of a sovereign prince. You have to be a perfect nullity, and yet never give anyone the right to complain." "How I dislike that big girl," thought he, watching as Mademoiselle de la Mole, as she walked away, her mother having called her over to present her to some women friends. "She is outrageously fashionable. Her dress is almost falling off her shoulders. She is even paler than before she went away. How colourless her hair is, through being so excessively fair. You could say light goes right through it. What haughtiness in that way of greeting people in her gaze. What queenly gestures." Mademoiselle de la Mole had just called to her brother as he was leaving the salon. Comte Norbert came up to Julien. "My dear Sorel," said he, "where do you wish me to pick you up at midnight for Monsieur de Retz's ball? He expressly charged me to bring you." "I am well aware to whom I owe such kindness," replied Julien, bowing almost to the ground. His ill temper, unable to find anything to fix on in the tone of politeness and even of interest with which Norbert had addressed him, started to vent itself on the reply that he, Julien, had made to this obliging offer. He found it contained a deal too much humility. That evening, arriving at the ball, he was impressed by the magnificence of the Hotel de Retz. The courtyard was covered by the immense tent of crimson canvas, dotted with golden stars. Nothing could be more elegant. Under this canopy, the courtyard had been turned into a wood of blossoming orange trees and oriel leanders. Their pots had been deeply enough buried for the oranges and oleanders to appear to spring from the ground. The path through which the coaches arrived was strewn with sand. To our young provincial, this whole arrangement seemed wonderful. He had no notion of such splendour. In an instant, his excited imagination was 1,000 miles away from ill humour, in the coach on the way to the ball. Norbert had been full of cheer, while Julian took a black view of everything. Hardly had they entered the courtyard than these roles were reversed. Norbert noticed only the few details that in the midst of such magnificence had not been perfectly done. He estimated the cost of each detail, and Julian saw that when he arrived at a high total, he showed something like jealousy and became cross. As for him, he was beguiled, admiring and almost made nervous by the strength of his emotion, and as he arrived in the first of the rooms used for dancing. There was pressure to move on to the door of the second room, but the crowd was so packed that it was impossible for him to go further. The second salon was decorated in the style of the Alhambra in Granada. "She's the queen of the ball, you must admit it," said a young mustachioed man whose shoulder was pushing into Julian's chest. "Mademoiselle Formant, who has been the prettiest girl the whole winter," replied the neighbour, "knows that she has been relegated to second place. See her strange expression. In truth, she's jamming on all her sail to be winning. Look at that gracious smile just at the moment she's dancing a part in the quadrille. Upon my honour, it's incredible. Mademoiselle de la Mole seems thoroughly superior to the pleasures of her triumph, which she is all too well aware of. One might say she is nervous of it charming the people she talks to. Excellent. That is the art of being seductive." Julian's efforts to catch a glimpse of this enchanting woman were useless. 7 or 8 men taller than him blocked his view. "There's a vast amount of flirtatiousness in that haughty reserve," declared the young man with the mustaches. "And those great blue eyes lowered so slowly just at the moment one thinks they will give the feelings away," continued his neighbour. "My word, nothing so artful. See how ordinary the lovely Formant looks beside her," added a third. "That air of reserve is just as if to say, how many delights could I set out before you, were you the man worthy of me?" "And who could be the man worthy of the sublime Matilda?" said the first. "Some sovereign prince, handsome, witty, well-built, a hero in the wars and about 20 years old. The natural son of the Emperor of Russia, to whom, in honour of this marriage, they had given a sovereign state, or quite simply the Comte de Thella, looking like a dressed-up peasant. The door became unblocked, and Julian was able to pass through. Since these tailor's dummies find her so remarkable, it might be worth the trouble to inspect her," he thought. "Let me see what it is these people regard as perfection." As his gaze travelled round in search of her, Matilda glanced at him. "My duty calls," said Julian to himself, but the only ill temper now was in his expression. His curiosity led him to step forward with a pleasure that Matilda's dress, cut so extremely low on her shoulders, speedily increased. Really, in a way, not very gratifying to Julian's pride. "There is something essentially youthful in her beauty," he thought. 5 or 6 young men, amongst whom Julian recognized those he had heard at the door, were between them. "You, monsieur, who have been here all winter," she called to him, "is this really the finest ball of the season?" He made no reply. "This Coulon quadrille seems excellent to me, and these ladies dance it perfectly." The young men turned round to see who could be the lucky fellow from whom she absolutely insisted on getting an answer. It turned out not to be an encouraging one. "I couldn't possibly be a judge of that, mademoiselle. I spend my life scribbling. This is the first ball of such splendour I have ever seen." The young men with mustaches were scandalised. "You're a wise man, Monsieur Sorel," she replied. "With an even more marked interest, you view all these balls, all these parties, as Jean-Jacques Rousseau did. Such follies amaze you, but do not seduce you." A mere name succeeded in stifling the fires of Julian's imagination and chased all illusions from his heart. His mouth assumed a perhaps exaggerated expression of disdain. "Jean-Jacques Rousseau," he replied, "is nothing but a fool. When he takes it upon himself to pronounce upon the great world, he understood nothing about it, and brought to it the heart of an upstart lackey." He wrote The Social Contract, said Matilda with veneration. In the middle of preaching about a republic and the downfall of the royal state, this upstart goes wild with happiness if a duke alters the direction of his after-dinner stroll to accompany one of his friends. Ah, yes, the Duke of Luxembourg at Montmorency, going with a certain Monsieur Coindet on the way to Paris, replied Mademoiselle de la Mole, with the unrestrained relish of a first taste of pedantry. She was intoxicated by her erudition, a little like the academician who discovered the existence of King Feretrius. Julian continued to look cutting and severe. Matilda had had a burst of enthusiasm. Her companion's coldness disconcerted her deeply. She was all the more put out because it was she who had accustomed to producing this effect on others. Just then the Marquise de Croisenois was eagerly trying to reach Mademoiselle de la Mole's side. She was held up temporarily 3 steps away, unable to get to her through the crush. He gazed at her while smiling at the obstacle in his way. In front of him was the young Marquise de Rouvray, a cousin of Matilda. She was leaning on the arm of her husband, to whom she had been married only a fortnight. The Marquise de Rouvray, also very young, was showing all of the fatuous amorousness that grips a man who, having made a marriage of convenience entirely organized by lawyers, discovers a perfectly beautiful being. Madame de Rouvray would become a duke on the death of his very aged uncle. While the Marquise de Croisenois, unable to get through the crowd, looked humorously at Matilda, she let her heavenly blue eyes dwell on him and his neighbours. What could be more banal, said she to herself, than this whole group? He is Croisenois, who wants to marry me. He is gentle, polished, and has perfect manners like Madame de Rouvray. If it weren't for the boredom these gentlemen generate, they would be perfectly amiable. He too would take me to a ball with the same controlled and satisfied expression on his face. A year after marriage, my coach, my horses, my gowns, my chateau, 20 leagues from Paris, all that would be as fine as it possibly could be. Everything that could be needed to make a parvenu die with envy, a Comtesse de Rouville, for example, and after that, Matilda found the very prospect tedious. The Marquise de Croisenois succeeded in reaching her and speaking to her, but she dreamt on without listening. The sound of his words was lost to her in the general murmur of the ball. Her eyes mechanically followed Julian, who had parted from her with an air that was respectful, but aloof and discontented. In a corner, far from the circulating mass, she noticed Comte Altamira, a man of whom the reader has already heard, under sentence of death in his own country. In Louis XIV's time, one of the ancestors had married a Prince de Conti, and the memory of this gave him some small protection against the congregation's police. So far as I can see, thought Matilda, a sentence of death is the only thing that confers distinction on a man. It is the only thing no one ever buys. Ah, what a fine epigram I have just produced. What a pity it didn't occur to me when it would have done me honour. Matilda had too much taste to introduce a witticism prepared in advance into a conversation, but she also had too much vanity not to be delighted with herself. An air of satisfaction replaced the bored expression on her face. The Marquise de Croisenois, who had been talking to her throughout, believed he was seeing his own success and redoubled his eloquence. What could some carping critic say against my epigram? Matilda asked herself. I would reply to them, the title of Baron of Vicomte can be bought, a cross can be given, my brother is just about to get one, and what has he ever done? A rank can be obtained, 10 years in a garrison or a relative in the war ministry, and a man becomes head of a squadron like Norbert, a great fortune. That's still the most difficult and therefore the most meritorious. And this is amusing, it is the exact opposite of what they say in books. Oh, all right, for a fortune you may marry Monsieur Rothschild's daughter. My saying really has depth. A sentence of death is still the only thing no one has ever thought of applying for. Do you know Comte Altamira? She asked Monsieur de Croisenois. She had the air of coming back from so far away, and this question was so little related to anything the poor Marquise had been talking about for the last 5 minutes that it gave his affability a jolt. Yet he was a man of wit, much renowned. Matilda has some eccentricity, thought he. It is an advantage, but she would confer such a fine social position on her husband. I don't know how this Marquise de la Mole does it. He is allied to the best men in all the parties. He is a man whom nobody can overshadow, and what's more, the eccentricity of Matilda may pass for genius. With high birth and plenty of money, genius is never absurd, and then what distinction can it can bestow? At other times, when she cares to be, she is so adept at the mingling of wit, individuality, and aptness which constitutes perfect charm. Since it is difficult to do two things well at the same time, the Marquise replied to Matilda in a vacant manner, as if reciting a lesson. Who doesn't know poor Altamira? And he told her the story of his failed conspiracy. Inept and absurd. Absurd indeed, said Matilda, as though speaking to herself. Nevertheless, he did do something. I want to see a man bring him to me, said she, to the disconcerted Marquise. Comte Altamira was one of the more vocal admirers of Mademoiselle de la Mole's haughty and almost insulting manner, according to him. She was one of the most beautiful creatures in Paris. How lovely she would be on a throne, he said to Monsieur de Croisenois, and he made no objection to being led over to her. There is never a shortage of people in society who would like to insist that nothing is in such bad taste as conspiracy. It has a Jacobinical odour, and what is more dismal than a failed Jacobin? Like Monsieur de Croisenois, Matilda viewed Altamira's liberalism satirically, but she listened with pleasure. A conspirator at a ball, thought she, what a pretty contrast. In this example, with his black mustachios, she thought she might find the feature of a lion in repose, but soon discovered that his mind had only one guiding principle, utility, the admiration of utility. This young comte thought nothing worthy of his attention unless it was capable of delivering government by two chambers to his native land. He gladly forsook Matilda, the most seductive woman at the ball, because he had noticed the entry of a Peruvian general. Despairing of Europe, poor Altamira was reduced to thinking that when the states of South America became strong and powerful, they might be able to deliver the liberty that Mirabeau had exported there back to Europe. A little eddy of young gentlemen with mustaches was approaching Matilda. She clearly realized that she had not put her spell on Altamira, and found herself piqued by the departure. She saw his dark eyes sparkle as he talked at the Peruvian general. Mademoiselle de la Mole studied the young Frenchman with that deep and earnest gaze none of her rivals could match. Which of them, she wondered, could get himself sentenced to death, even supposing all the circumstances favoured him? Her strange stare flattered those of little wit, but made the others uneasy. They dreaded the explosion of some witticism, biting and hard to answer. High breeding gives 100 advantages, the absence of which offends me, reflected Matilda. I see this in Julian's case, but it enfeebles those qualities of the soul which allow one to become sentenced to death. Just at that moment, someone next to her remarked, "This Comte Altamira is the second son of the Prince of San Nazaro Pimentel." It was a Pimentel who attempted to save Conradin, who was beheaded in 1268. They are one of the noblest families in Naples. There, said Matilda to herself, that bears out my maxims brilliantly. High birth destroys the force of character without which one cannot get sentenced to death, so I am destined not to be very clever this evening, and since I am nothing but a woman like any other, very well then I must dance. She gave way to the solicitations of the Marquise de Croisenois, who for the last hour had been urging her to do the galop. To distract herself from her failure as a philosopher, Matilda set out to be completely bewitching, and Monsieur de Croisenois was enchanted. But neither the dance itself, nor the wish to please one of the most handsome men at court, nothing could divert Matilda. It was impossible to have a greater success. She was queen of the ball. She saw that, but she saw it with indifference. What a flat existence I would live with a creature like Croisenois, she said to herself as he led her back to her place an hour later. Where will I ever find joy? She added sadly. If after being absent for 6 months I don't experience it right in the middle of the ball, that's the envy of every woman in Paris. And furthermore, I am surrounded by the homage of a company I cannot imagine being better composed. There are no bourgeois elements here, except for a few peers and one or two Julians, perhaps. And then, added she with increasing distress, what advantages has fate not granted me? High birth, wealth, youth, alas, everything save happiness. The most dubious of my assets, moreover, are those about which, though they have been talking to me all evening, intelligence, I believe, in that, for it is obvious that I frighten them all. If they dare raise a serious subject, then at the end of 5 minutes' conversation they arrive panting, as though they have made a great discovery, at whatever it is I have been saying for the last hour. I am beautiful, I have the asset for which Madame de Staël would have sacrificed everything, and yet it is a fact that I am dying of boredom. Is there any reason I should be less bored when I have changed my name for that of the Marquise de Croisenois? But, dear God, she added, almost wanting to weep, isn't he a perfect young man? The masterwork of modern upbringing, you can hardly look at him without his finding something agreeable and even witty to say, and he is brave, but that Sorel is most peculiar, she said to herself, and her eyes exchanged their melancholy expression for one of annoyance. I made it clear that I had something to say to him, and he has not deigned to return to me. All right, there we go. That's another chapter done. A little bit of a change in perspective here. That's kind of cool. Have your say about that one over at the subreddit. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.